From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. On this show, we always like to talk about those things that are inspirational. Miracles, those things of the light. But of course, there's also things of the dark. And we just passed Halloween, of course, and talking about the spooks and the ghouls and the demons and the devils. And people get really wrapped up about that in for Halloween. But beyond Halloween, this is a reality that plagues our entire world. And there's a brand new book that's out called The History of Exorcism. It's written by Adam Bly, the Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh. And he'll be talking to us about some of the fascinating aspects of exorcism, including some bone-chilling details that you won't want to miss. And speaking of holy water, as it's used in exorcism, we have Sean McAfee. He's got a brand new book called Compendium of Sacramentals. It's out from Tan Books. And it talks about all those things throughout Christian history that have remarkable power and inspiration for the faithful. So we'll be excited to talk to Sean later in the show. And check out my series, They Might Be Saints, which airs every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. This week, Sister Marie de Mondragrance is the subject of the episode. And this was the very first They Might Be Saints episode, so this always has a special place in my heart. And in this episode, you'll learn the fascinating story of Sister Marie de Mondragrance, a French nun. You have to follow her extraordinary efforts to locate the House of Mary, the Mother of Jesus, as she travels to Ephesus, Turkey, to bring this treasure back to the Catholic Church. So check that one out on next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And also my other series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I'll be going to Champion, Wisconsin, where the Virgin Mary appeared to Belgian farm worker Adele Bryce in the year 1859. It's the first and only church-approved Marian apparition in United States history. So check that one out, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN Television. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project. For today, we've got Our Lady of the Rosary from Chiquinquirá, from Maracaibo, Venezuela, also Colombia. The Might Be Saint of the Day is Blessed Fernando Santa Maria, who lived from 1883 to 1902 in Italy. And the question of the week, which apparitions occur without Our Lady speaking? I'll do my best to answer that one later in the show. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. Just this past week, Pope Francis recognized a miracle attributed to the intercession of Cardinal Eduardo Pironio. And on November 28th, Pope Francis recognized this miracle, giving his assent to the publication of a decree regarding the miracle, thus paving the way for Pironio's beatification. And the newspaper La Nación reported that the miracle was the healing of a year-and-a-half-year-old boy, Juan Manuel Franco, who had ingested a toxic paint powder that his mom was using for fixing up the house. And the miracle happened in Mar del Plata, the city where Pironio was the bishop. And the child was suffering acute respiratory distress on December 2nd, 2006, the day that the March of Hope was held, and that march was an initiative also started by Pironio. And the parish priest of the Franco family had distributed a holy card for that march with an image of Pironio, and Juan Manuel's parents began to pray for his intercession using the prayer on this holy card. And 2 days later, the boy was starting to get better, and 5 days later, he was lucid and breathing on his own. And Cardinal Pironio's beatification is expected in Luján in Argentina. I was just there 2 months ago, and that's before the end of the year. So that is a new miracle being recognized by Pope Francis. And let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer that gets the answer the fastest. And people who know me, my friends, know I love pub trivia. On a random night, you might find me in a pub playing pub trivia, but this is Catholic Pub Trivia. So do your best and send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and we'll see if you have the right answer. And last week, we asked the question on They Might Be Saints. This past week, we aired the episode of Venerable Bishop Barriga. And the question is, what friend of Bishop Barriga of Italian descent is also a venerable? And he's from Wisconsin. And that answer was Father Samuel Mazzucchelli. So if you got that answer, thank you for writing in. And the fastest person is going to win that prize. And for this week, the question, we're talking about sacramentals in one of the interviews today. And the question is, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, what are the three types of sacramentals? And if you think you know that answer, want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe we'll be answering your question on the air next week. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be getting ready to talk to Adam Bly, author of The History of Exorcism. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Of course, on this show, you know, we talk a lot about miracles and saints and the Virgin Mary and her apparitions and some of these things that have brought great inspiration to us throughout the centuries of Christianity. And then there are those things that perhaps aren't as inspiring, and for some people, they inspire fear. We're talking, of course, about the devil and the necessity of the rite of exorcism in our Catholic Church. And we're so excited today to be joined by one of our favorite guests, and that's Adam Bly. He's the Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and he's the author of a brand new book called The History of Exorcism. Welcome back to the program today, Adam.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
And I think this, you know, people are fascinated with this topic, both Christians and non-Christians, and the idea that that there are demons that need to be expelled through a rite of exorcism. I think that catches some people off guard. Even some Catholics don't fully understand it. But the history dates way back, doesn't it? And I think that from my mindset, I always would think that maybe exorcism began with Jesus casting out demons when he was on the earth. But it dates back earlier to that, doesn't it?
Yes, this is a kind of a universal human experience that you find in all the major religions of the world, and going back as far as we can, you know, as far as we can go in history. So, at the time of Jesus, the idea of exorcism was well established, and it was well known that there were kind of itinerant rabbis or exorcists that would go around and do exorcisms. And so it wasn't surprising when people saw him doing it at that time.
And of course, we see Jesus casting out demons in the Gospels. And then we have he confers those powers onto his apostles, who then carried on further to this modern day. How did it go? How did things progress from the time of Jesus to what we see in early Christianity, perhaps?
So it's a long, and I actually found it a very interesting story, which is why I thought it might be interesting to put it into a book for people. You know, in the very earliest church, we just had apostles and the followers. You know, we remember the 72, you know, the faithful, and then there were the apostles. And in the earliest church, exorcisms were done by people that were thought to be, you know, particularly holy. Usually, these were ascetics, people living kind of like, if you think of a cloistered nun or a cloistered monk, these would be kind of the desert fathers, the desert mothers, who had withdrawn from the world. There's no, as far as I can find, there is no reference to a married person or a parent doing exorcisms. It was always people that were really devoted to prayer. So in the early church, it was actually the lay people, and what they would do is they would identify people that seemed to have this gift from God, and then they would bring the possessed to them.
Oh, fascinating. And then how that's an interesting thing, that it required some years before the process actually formalized. And when did we see the Catholic Church first going beyond sort of those early days or that transition period from the apostles and beyond to these holy fathers of the desert fathers, as you said? Where do we see the process formalizing a little bit and the church seeing the need to have a rite for exorcism?
Well, you see the beginning of the formalization of it in the 300s, after the church gets accepted by the Roman Empire and gets a little more stable. you start seeing the effort to produce kind of standard rites of the church, you know, a book for the Mass and a book for baptisms, and including, you know, a book for exorcism. Now, in the early church, in those early centuries, from, you know, 200 or 300 on up to the Middle Ages, there was not one universal book, and that was true for the Mass and for other things also. It was regional because we didn't have the internet, we didn't have the printing press, and it was kind of a regional church. And so what you saw was, you know, the local version of exorcism, and that took different forms. And during those centuries, you had the transition from particularly holy people doing it to clergy. And so the church saw in her wisdom that this is a potentially dangerous and difficult ministry, and so started restricting it instead of to remarkably holy people that seemed to have a charism for it, started restricting it to clergy that the bishop would be aware of, as opposed to people just freely doing this on their own. And then eventually they kind of outlawed non-clergy doing the formal exorcisms. Now, people could still pray for deliverance, but in terms of using the church's official exorcisms, they eventually, through canon law, essentially, though canon law was more primitive in those days, basically made it a restricted ministry. And then in 1614 was the first time we saw a standardized universal version of the exorcism rite that was used throughout the church wherever it was.
And how long was that actual rite used throughout the centuries, that first rite?
The first standard rite of 1614 was used up until today. It is still in use. In 1998, they produced a new rite of exorcism, which was, by the way, just part of the Vatican II process where every rite of the church had to be revised. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't created because there was a deficiency or a problem with the 1614 rite. It was just the law of the council was every rite had to be revised. And so you see the 1614 rite consistently used until 1998. And then it was quickly, basically immediately allowed to use the old rite if the priest wanted to. And then there was a few more shifts in the law, and where things settled were, as long as your bishop says it's okay, you can use the old rite or the new one, basically at will, if that's what your bishop wishes. And then there's some bishops that only let the exorcist use the new rite of 1998.
Fascinating. And we're talking today with Adam Bly, the Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and also author of the brand new book, The History of Exorcism. And if you were to compare the two rites, the one from 1614 and the one from 1998, what changed? Is it a matter of language, or is something dramatically different between the two?
There's kind of two levels of changes there, Michael. The first one is the approach. And so the theological approach of the old rite was to essentially remind the demon of what it was, remind it of its station through gospel reading, psalms, and other adjurations that were in the rite, and then command it to give up its name and then command it to leave. And that's something, that command was between the exorcist and the demon. The new rite has a different theological approach that essentially asks the Holy Spirit through the baptismal graces and the baptismal promises that the person has received, asking the Holy Spirit to cast the demon out. Now, they did start to, they did include as optional prayers some of that more combative language that we see in the 1614 rite. There was some feedback from the exorcists around the world, and they kind of rolled back in some of that combative direct language. But essentially, the theological approach is quite different. And of course, you know, you might be thinking ahead and wondering, what if the person's not baptized? You know, is this applicable? And that's an interesting question. And we kind of rely on the mercy and the grace of God. And I think some exorcists just change some of the wording because of the necessity. If a person's not baptized, we can't call on the baptismal promises there. So, you know, that's an interesting wrinkle with the new rite.
Fascinating. We're talking today with Adam Bly, Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and author of the brand new book, The History of Exorcism, from Sophia Institute Press. And when we look at
the guidelines that come down to us for exorcists. We see St. Charles Borromeo as being influential in that production. Who was he, and why was he so influential with the guidelines for exorcism?
Well, he was influential for, I mean, there was actually a number of saints that were influential, but he was influential for having some knowledge of this in terms of the practical ministry, both that had been passed down through the centuries, kind of tips and guidelines that had been passed down from experienced exorcists, but also because he was regarded as knowledgeable about angelology and dealing with the supernatural, and in the case of the demons, the preternatural. And so there was, you know, you're looking for somebody with some experience with exorcism that's practical, but also somebody that has a proper theological understanding of what these creatures are, and that leads to kind of an increased facility in how you deal with them. So if you understand how their mind works a little bit, or their position before God, if you understand that clearly, you can cut through a lot of the demonic tricks and distractions because you know the truth of the situation. And so he had a lot of these insights, both practical and theological, that led to being really helpful in writing the guidelines.
And in your book, The History of Exorcism, you also mention other saints who helped drive out demons, even from the great beyond. Who are some of these saints that you feature in your book?
Well, what the church discovered fairly early on with saints in general was that at the tombs of people that were regarded as particularly holy or regarded as saints, just taking somebody troubled to that tomb would sometimes free them. And actually, in some regions, they would just bring the person and keep them in the tomb or the church that had the crypt in it overnight, and the person would sometimes be freed by morning. And this was also, there's a parallel with this with healings that the church noticed early on around the bodies of saints, which is what led to what we see with relics today, where, you know, this veneration of relics or bringing relics. So you're essentially bringing part of the tomb to the situation, whether it's a healing or a deliverance need. And there's actually not just, we don't want to think about that there's a particular saint that's helpful. What we see is in the actual practical exorcism ministry today, it depends on the spirit that you're dealing with in terms of what sin that it fosters. And it also depends on what the person needs in their journey of conversion, the human being that's troubled at that point in the case. And so we don't want to think that, oh, it's only Saint so-and-so that is helpful with exorcism. Mm-hmm. It's actually any saint that is relevant for that person's conversion or to wrestle with the sin that that demon promotes. And so, you know, some of these have been often, again, kind of reflecting the early history, the cloistered and religious saints have been, you know, very effective for some people, but it can be any saint. And we see that today. We use relics of many different saints, and it depends on the situation. The bottom line message there is the church noticed very early on that the living saint was super effective, but when they were in heaven, their body was reflective of that status in heaven and was continued to be very effective for helping with deliverance.
Amazing. We're talking today with Adam Bly, Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and author of the brand new book from Sophia Institute Press called The History of Exorcism. And I know in your book you have you highlight some of these very famous examples of actual exorcisms, and I know that you yourself are present for some exorcisms on a weekly basis through your work for the Diocese of Pittsburgh. For those people who have doubts, those people who say, this is something from the past, some carryover from an earlier, more superstitious age, exorcisms don't really do anything, and there's no such thing as genuine demonic possession, what would you say to them? What are the signs of a true demonic possession?
Yeah, so the church had the same concern whether this was real or a medical problem or a mental health problem centuries ago. And she figured out through the experience of many, many people down through time that there's certain signs of possession that you need to look for that kind of go beyond what we could explain away. So, for instance, one of the classic signs is knowledge of all languages, not just a few, not just one or two, but any language the demon is interrogated in, it uses with perfect facility, can speak them, it can respond to them properly. So, we had a case here in Pennsylvania, somebody raised on a farm with a high school education, only spoke English, but they were interrogated in English, French, Latin, Lithuanian, and German, and properly responded to all the languages. So, what I always say is schizophrenia doesn't make you suddenly fluent in ancient languages, right?
Right.
That just isn't part of the disease, nor any other disease does that. The second one is knowledge of hidden things. So a common one is they will air your secret sins to everybody in the room to shame you and try to, rattle your cage and maybe get you to withdraw from this ministry. So again, manic depression doesn't make you suddenly know somebody's secrets. That's especially when they're very specific. I'm not talking about, oh, you stole something once or something vague. I'm talking about, very detailed stuff that reveals that they were present and know all the details of your sins. So that one we can't explain away. The next one is a little weaker, and that's detecting the holy. So if we have a blessed crucifix and one that isn't blessed, you might say, well, a person who's faking knows they should recoil from a crucifix, but they won't react to the one that isn't blessed. Now, they might react to the symbolism of it, but let's take it a little further. If we had two bottles of water that were identical that we bought at the gas station, outside of the room, one of them's blessed, one isn't. The possessed person, even in the human state, can tell you which one is blessed every time, and you can do it again with 10 bottles of which one is blessed. They will still always be able to pick out the one that is blessed. I've also seen them tell the name of the saint whose relic is in your pocket that you haven't mentioned to anybody or shown to anybody, but the demon knows which saints are present in the form of their relics. And then the final one is strength beyond their condition, and that's the weakest of the signs because we do see bursts of strength with adrenaline, and in psychiatric settings, I've worked for a number of years in the prisons in psychology, I've seen psychotic strength. The difference with this is they never get tired, and the body never weakens. And when the person comes out of the demonic state after the exorcism, they're not tired or sore. They're not aware that their body did these extraordinary exertions. And by the way, Michael, the strength is not just, oh, wow, they're strong. I mean, I'm talking about, not very tall women that maybe weigh 120 pounds, throwing five men around the room for hours without getting tired and overpowering them repeatedly. You're talking about pretty remarkable displays of strength.
Absolutely amazing. We've been talking today with Adam Bly, Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh. You can tell by some of his stories that he's the real deal, and he's been involved in some extremely fascinating cases. And the brand new book is called The History of Exorcism. It's out from Sophia Institute Press. Adam, for people who want to find out more about your ministry or to pick up this book, The History of Exorcism, where can they go for more?
Well, that book can be bought from Sophia Institute Press's website, and that's always the best way to get your Catholic books, because if you go through Amazon, they take a big chunk and they really hurt the publisher. And then I have a site for the just information for the public called religiousdemonology.com, and I also have a radio show actually aired here on the EWTN network on Saturdays called The Spirit World that I do with my friend Debbie Giorgiani. And there we take calls and answer questions and kind of amplify some of these issues.
Wonderful.
Not amplify in the sense of like alarm people or scare them, but amplify the explanations and try to explain them.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, as always, Adam Bly, for joining us on today's program and for putting together this brand new book, The History of Exorcism. Thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Michael. God bless you, and God bless your listeners.
God bless. That was Adam Bly, Paratus of Religious Demonology for the Diocese of Pittsburgh and author of The History of Exorcism. Check this one out from Sophia Institute Press. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week, which apparitions occur without Our Lady speaking? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People tune into this show. They send me questions from around the world. People send questions about things that are happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love getting these questions. I do my best to answer them. And I love answering questions in person. When I'm giving a talk, I talk about go to about 20 different speaking engagements per year to different parishes, conferences, shrines. And I always speak for about 45 minutes. These days, I'm speaking a lot about Eucharistic miracles, which dovetails with the Eucharistic revival. But we always leave questions at the end, 15, 20, 30, 40 minutes sometimes it goes at the end of a talk. But I really enjoy doing that. For people who want to invite me to speak at your parish, go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and click on the contact tab. But we've got a really good question coming in through email this week. It's from Gene. He asks, "Dear Miracle Hunter, which apparitions occur without Our Lady speaking?" Thank you, Gene. Well, thanks, Gene, for this question, and it's a good one. Throughout Christian history, we have these occasions where Mary walks amongst us, where she delivers these messages. We think commonly of Fatima or Lourdes or Guadalupe, these occasions where Mary has messages for the local people or for the world. And but there are some very rare occasions where Mary doesn't say anything at all. And we have famous examples like Our Lady of Knock in Ireland, where she appeared to about 20 witnesses in 1879, and she stood in the rain with images of St. Joseph and St. John and a lamb representing Jesus. There were no verbal messages delivered in that one-time apparition. Or we talk about other cases as well. In Pontmain in France in 1871, the apparitions which brought to an end the Franco-Prussian War. And in that case, we see Mary not saying anything, but she appears to the children, showing symbols and unfurling a banner. We also have cases like Zaytun in Egypt, which, in my opinion, is one of the most fascinating claims of a Marian apparition in history. From 1968 to 1971, Mary walked on the rooftops of St. Mark's Coptic Orthodox Church, and it was witnessed over 3 years by Christians, Muslims, Jews, and atheists gathered in large crowds there, and no messages were given there either. And also in Batania, Venezuela, there's a church-approved apparition to Maria Esperanza. But on this one particular date, March 25th, 1984, we see as many as 108 witnesses of all walks of life being there to see Mary. And so this was a case where Mary didn't give a message either. So on some very rare occasions, it's not many times, but Mary appears without a message. And perhaps it just is a call for us to reflect on her sorrowful heart in these moments. But thank you for the great question, Gene. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe we'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we talk about the Marian devotion of the day. You all know Fatima on May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th. But did you know that for every day of the calendar year, there's a different Marian feast day or commemoration of Marian titles from all around the world? And so for today's day, November 18th, we've got Our Lady of the Rosary from Chiquinquirá in Maracaibo in Venezuela in the year 1709, and she's also a patroness of Colombia as well. And the story goes that on Tuesday, November 18th in 1709, a poor washerwoman from Nueva Zamora de Maracaibo, she was named Saladilla, she had recovered an old image of the Virgin on the shores and hung it on her wall. One day she was deep in doing her chores, and she did not pay attention to a series of knocks that were heard on the wall where the picture hung. The blows were heard again, and the third time she went and she saw the image of the Virgin of Chiquinquirá illuminated. In the street she shouted, "Miracle!" And with this began a great devotion. In this city, every year on November 18th is celebrated the Feria de Chinita in honor of the Virgin. She's the patroness and queen of Colombia, the state of Zulia in Venezuela, and the city of Caraz in Peru. And that is Our Lady of Chiquinquirá from Maracaibo in Venezuela in the year 1709. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to the 365 Days with Mary website, or you can download the app or pick up the book, 365 Days with Mary. Now let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood. Perhaps these are the servants of God's venerables, blesseds, before they have all their miracles and are declared a saint. And so we always like to report on the sainthood news to let you know who's coming down the pipeline, so to speak, who are the next saints to be announced. And on November 8th, Holy Father Pope Francis, he received an audience as Reverend Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints. And during this audience, the Pope authorized this dicastery to promulgate a decree regarding the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Elisa of the Blessed Virgin Mary. She was born Elisa Vecai, and she's the founder of the Congregation of the Third Order of Descalced Carmelite Nuns, now Theresian Carmelite Nuns. She was born in October 15, 1831, in Achanchuruth in India, and she died on July 18th in Varaspucha in India as well. And on the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints website, it says she was the founder of the Congregation of the Third Order of Descalced Carmelite Nuns, now Theresian Carmelite Sisters. She always had great trust in God, and the hope of celestial goal supported her in her difficulties, which she faced with serenity. She shone heroically, her life shone during difficulties linked to the foundation of the new congregation. And so that is the new venerable that we have, Elisa of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And with one miracle, she'll be declared a blessed. And with two miracles, she will be declared a saint. And we also like to talk about the might-be saint of the day, the person whose life or whose death anniversary or feast day occurs on the day's date. And for today's date, we have Blessed Fernando Santa Maria, who lived from 1883 to 1902 in Italy. And he was born on May 4th in Ponte Curvo in Procine in Italy. His name was Fernando Santa Maria. He was the oldest of five children. Fernando's father ran a rope-making business, and the boy was drawn to religious life from an early age and was stressed when he had to spend his life at work instead of in the church. In 1899, less than 18 years old, he became a Passionist cleric and seminarian at Paliano in Italy. While in seminary, he was stricken with acute meningitis, but he never slacked in his studies or prayer and set an example of living a holy version of life you are given. He died on November 18, 1902 at Carcano in Italy of meningitis, as I mentioned, and Pope John Paul II declared him venerable on May 14, 1991. And in 1995, Pope John Paul II, on January 29th, declared him blessed. With one more miracle, Blessed Fernando Santa Maria will be Saint Fernando. And for people who want to check out the series, They Might Be Saints, you can go to theymightbesaints.com or tune in every Wednesday. This week coming up, November 29th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, They Might Be Saints, Sister Maria de Mandat Grance. We tell the fascinating story of Sister Marie, and you follow her extraordinary efforts to locate the House of Mary, the Mother of Jesus, as she travels to Ephesus, Turkey, to bring this treasure to the Catholic Church. And you can find out more at theymightbesaints.com or pick up the book, They Might Be Saints, available from EWTN Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Sean McAfee about his brand new book, Compendium of Sacramentals. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We talk a lot about miracles on this show. Maybe that's all we talk about on this show. And there have been stories of people who have had incredible experiences throughout the ages due to the presence in their life of sacramentals. And sacramentals, for most Catholics, maybe modern Catholics, don't really know all the sacramentals or don't know the ones according to tradition that have been handed down to us. But there's a great new book that's out that puts these all together in a compendium, and that is The Compendium of Sacramentals, and that's out from Tan Books, authored by Sean McAfee. And that falls in line with any of these other compendium books that Tan has put together. And they're all beautifully appointed books, hardcover with beautiful photography and beautiful layout with great content. So I'm excited to see this new book that's out, Compendium of Sacramentals. And we welcome to the show today the author, Sean McAfee. Welcome to the show today, Sean.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I'm a big fan.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for putting together this book. It's beautiful. And I think that people need to know about the sacramentals of the church. And those people who also have an interest or a devotion along these lines are going to absolutely love it. It's Compendium of Sacramentals. And as I mentioned, it falls in line with the other compendium of Tan Book series. So they're also well done. Now, when you got started with this book, what inspired you to write a book about sacramentals? It's not something that we see in many books, for example.
Well, I'm a convert, and of course, you come with a curious nature. I converted the church about 12 years ago, and of course, didn't come across the Tiber with all of my questions answered. So as I grew to love devotions like the rosary, or I grew to start to pray the divine office, or carry a medal around my neck, or hang crucifixes on my walls around my home, or even go for a traditional Latin rite baptism for one of my children. You know, I noticed there were exorcisms involved in that. I started to really ask myself a lot of questions about what the church teaches about sacramentals, and all three of those fall into the category. So the genesis of the book, to kind of put it concisely, started with a very small book in the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers. It was about 18,000 words. And of course, I was exploding with about 90,000 words worth of content and ideas to write on. So I pitched this book to Tan, and I pitched it as a much more simple book than they offered me. And they put it a part of the compendium series, which is, of course, you know, full hardcover, 18 by 12, you know, color pages and beautiful sacred art on every page. I feel very blessed and grateful to be given the opportunity to write this book.
Absolutely. And so when you laid out this book, how did you group the sacramentals and divide them up in your book?
That was really difficult because the church historically has had kind of separate groups of sacramentals itself. But most recently, especially within the Catechism of the Catholic Church and the Document of Vatican II, Sacrosanctum Concilium, breaks sacramentals into three distinct categories, and that's blessings, and then the second is exorcisms, and then the third is items and devotions of piety. So those are popular devotions. I also wanted to kind of acknowledge and kind of put a, I guess, a formal nod to the fact that the church also recognizes as those, that last category, popular devotions, gestures. So that's like the sign of the cross or genuflecting or kneeling or even bowing at the altar. Those are all sacramentals. So the book really breaks it up that way. And then there's, of course, a really great introduction chapter to kind of get everybody started on Sacramentals 101.
Absolutely. And so let's start from the very beginning in the sense of for Catholics who are just entering the church or maybe see sacramentals or don't have an understanding of sacramentals and their history, if you had to define sacramental, everybody knows sacraments, but what is sacramental?
So they're sacred signs which bear resemblance to the sacrament. They signify effects which are particularly of a spiritual nature, and they are obtained through the intercessions of the church. And that's really a lot to unpack, but what it means is that they dispose us to receive the sacraments. They're supposed to sanctify our daily life through devotion, through visual interception of the truths of our faith. You know, you stare at a crucifix on a wall. It's supposed to move your heart and move you to, of course, the sacraments that actually give us that efficacious grace for sanctification of our soul so that one day we may enter the kingdom of heaven.
Absolutely. No, that's wonderful. And for those people who perhaps have questions about sacramentals, again, maybe similar position, they're coming into the church or they just don't know, how do we distinguish the superstition from sacramentals? What is important to note about the power of sacramentals and what isn't a sacramental?
Yeah, great question. And I try to, in the context of the book and within its content, I attempt to not like hammer Catholics or anybody else reading the book for their wonderful intent with the use of these sacramentals, but there's definitely kind of like a line I try to draw to help encourage good behavior. So let's just take like one common example, like the wearing of a rosary or the adornment of somebody's rearview mirror with a rosary. You know, that's a perfectly acceptable practice. I could see it akin to hanging a crucifix on the wall in a home. But where the superstition comes in on where is where the believer believes that that is going to have an effect on, let's say, their safety. So you don't hang a sacramental like that from your rearview mirror, thinking, okay, now my guardian angel is going to protect me. Well, that's not really the way that it works. There are no direct effects associated with any sacramental. It's a huge misnomer with even powerful sacramentals like holy water that they will absolve venial sin. What absolves venial sin is the contrition in a believer's heart and repentance for their sin. At that moment, our catechism teaches us they are forgiven of their sin. Of course, there's a sacramental way to go ahead and finish that penance. So in a short and concise way of saying it, the sacramentals are there not to help us in a superstitious way, you know, get out of jail free card or get out of trouble card or keep us safe card, but rather they're supposed to move us to literally going and receiving the sacrament. So that's what the church means in its definition. They say they're sacred signs which bear resemblance and signify the effects of the spiritual nature through the intercession of the church.
We're talking today with Sean McAfee, author of the brand new book just out this week, A Compendium of Sacramentals, Encyclopedia of the Church's Blessings, Signs, and Devotions. It's from Tan Books, and it's one of these beautiful compendium books from Tan Books with a beautiful hardcover and full-color photography and beautiful layout. So I encourage people to check this one out, Compendium of Sacramentals. Can you talk a little bit about how the book is organized as far as what kinds of photography is used, what kind of layout is used, what kind of explanations are given in the formatting of this book?
Yeah, I scrubbed every possible resource I could to give the reader really the most comprehensive, I believe, the most comprehensive book on sacramentals that has certainly been written within the last 100 years since Sullivan's Externals of the Faith. But I put a collection of sacramentals and stories in here and quotes from previous catechisms, you know, dating back at least 700 years. The book has a ton of information, but in the development of the book, really the publisher always gets the say, right? So the publisher, following the compendium series, they have really the river. They call it the river, and that's the text between all of the images. So in the book, I really try to make every chapter kind of communicate more or less a similar bit of content, and that's, you know, a definition and possibly some examples. I want to tell readers how they can use this practice in their daily life or how they might encounter this within the world. I try to ask, because every sacramental is just a little bit different, and the church does provide certain restrictions sometimes, or at least certain investitures on different sacramentals, like, let's say, scapulars, the brown scapular. You know, there's actually an investiture with a Carmelite order that one is supposed to have in order to be able to wear that and receive the Sabbatine privilege that is so famous now. Right. So I really try to bring out things like that, but then I try to fill, you know, the pages with a lot of, you know, kind of a little, some tips, you know, some suggestions, but then also, of course, we can glean on the wisdom of the church throughout the ages. So I try to, you know, tell stories that might summon some inspiration with believers who are reading the book, or even some apologetics with those who are really unsure exactly how to defend these pious practices. Because certainly, especially within the devotional section of the book, there's numerous devotions that I go over, like the Rosary or to the Sacred or to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. They're going to run into questions about Mary as they talk to their friends or neighbors or family about this book. So I try to fill the book with a little bit of apologetics too. I really try to cover the entire gamut of what somebody might want to know or need to know eventually for either their use or defense or just general knowledge of these sacramentals.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Sean McAfee, author of the brand new book, Compendium of Sacramentals, out from Tan Books and part of the Compendium series from Tan Books. Absolutely beautiful book. And one of the things that I, in addition to your tips for defending the sacramentals and explaining them to people who have objections, I think that's great, but I really like the in-depth guidance and instruction for using and practicing sacramentals. I think that a lot of people, maybe new Catholics, maybe Catholics who haven't really used sacramentals, they might learn about the object but not actually know how to use them in their own life. So I think that's an important aspect of this book. Talk a little bit about why you included that.
Well, of course. I wanted to arm, like I want to be armed. I wanted to give readers not just information, but, I wanted to guide them. I wanted to, if I could, be an informal mentor to them on some of these pious practices, some of the maybe some pitfalls that they want to avoid, discouragement in prayer or this or that. But also, especially with sacramentals, or especially the physical ones, I want to help them understand exactly, how to care for these things. And some people might not take this into consideration, even if they're a good, well-intentioned Catholic. The Church does have concise teaching about how to dispose of or repair these, or even go in and receiving blessings on them. So, for example, if you're like me, I have six kids, and my kids, yes, they've broken a crucifix or two. They've broken some rosaries. They've tossed medals in the trash on accident. The Church doesn't want us to treat these as ordinary objects. They are, of course, blessed. Some of them are consecrated, like a chalice is consecrated for sacred use. So we don't want to just dispose of them, even if they are tattered and torn and broken and unrepairable. They want us to dispose of them along with the dignity of these items. So they ask us, they suggest two different forms of that, and that's either to burn them, to incinerate them, to ashes, or to bury them like we would holy water. So those are the kinds of things that I try to, make readers aware of throughout the page of the book in order to help them, help some of them with either their conscience or just help them, overcome ignorance.
Absolutely. Talking today with Sean McAfee, author of the book, Compendium of Sacramentals. For what is your great hope with this book? I know it's kind of a tricky topic, sacramentals. Not everybody is running out to the store to find out more about sacramentals. What is your hope for people who may stumble across this book or be given this book as a gift for Christmas or otherwise? What will people gain from reading your book?
I think that this is like the secret topic that most Catholics haven't really acknowledged that they want to know more about. Whenever we think, if you were to ask 99 or 100 people about, if you were to say, what's the first image that comes to mind when I say the word Catholicism? They might think of the Pope, they might think of a priest, but chances are they're going to think of a physical object. They're going to think of a crucifix. They're going to think of a rosary or something like that, or maybe even a devotion. And so I think that every Catholic, especially new converts, wanting to learn about the faith, I think that they have this deep desire to know about these items that they've become so familiar with. I think they want to know them deeper. They might not realize it yet, but I think that the book will really trigger a lot of that curiosity. So I'm really happy about that. But overall, I'll be honest, I really just want sacramentals to serve their purpose in the Church, which is to lead the faithful to a more holy and sacramental lifestyle.
Wonderful. And where can people find out more about you and this book, Compendium of Sacramentals?
Sure. I have a website, seanmcafee.com. I'm kind of revamping it, launching this book right now. I also edit and write for epicpew.com. I've started that website about, 9 years ago. And you can find this book, first of all, what I always ask listeners to do, please go to your local Catholic bookstore. These are, the small businesses of America are a backbone of our economy, but Catholic bookstores also support so many families. So of course, go there, ask for books like this from Sean McAfee or from Michael Hunter. and then I ask you to, go to, of course, tanbooks.com, where you can find a great discount coming up this holiday season on the book, or just Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Anywhere you can find books, you'll find this one.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Sean McAfee, for putting together this book, Compendium of Sacramentals, and for joining us on today's program.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
God bless. That was Sean McAfee. Check out this book, Compendium of Sacramentals, Encyclopedia of the Church's Blessings, Signs, and Devotions. It's a beautiful hardcover, and it's the top new release in religion encyclopedias on Amazon. So people are going to really enjoy this book. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio. Check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Adam Bly, author of The History of Exorcism, and Sean McAfee for his new book, Compendium of Sacramentals, out from Tan Books. Tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, explore with the Miracle Hunter. I travel to Champion, Wisconsin, where the Virgin Mary appeared to Belgian farm worker Adele Bryce in 1859. This is the first and only church-approved Marian apparition in United States history. Check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available from EWTNRC.com. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.